Welcome, market participants, to Leading Voices in Credit, KBRA's monthly podcast that welcomes expert viewpoints from the most experienced players in credit markets. I'm Van Hesser, Chief Strategist at KBRA. Joining me today is Craig Packer, co-president of Blue Owl Capital, which in 7 short years has become a leader in sponsor-backed direct lending to the upper middle market and large-sized firms. Craig is head of the firm's credit platform and serves as chief executive officer of each of Blue Owl's 7 business development companies. In total, Blue Owl has more than $165 billion in assets under management, $85 billion of which is in credit. Now, previously, Craig co-founded Owl Rock Capital, the predecessor firm to Blue Owl's credit platform, in 2016, after spending 10 years at Goldman Sachs, ultimately serving there as co-head of leverage finance. Prior to Goldman, Craig was global head of high-yield capital markets at Credit Suisse, coming over from DLJ in that merger. Craig, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me.
So you've had a long, winding road through a lot of what is very topical these days in credit markets. You left the public markets in 2016 to start Owl Rock, a predecessor to Blue Owl. As you look back, what's been the most surprising revelation to you going from public markets to private markets?
It was certainly a big decision personally and professionally. I tend to be a pretty methodical thinker, and I spent a lot of time thinking about it. I was approached by Doug Ostrover, who was my partner, who I'd worked with previously in my career, about joining him to start a new firm. And actually, I spent quite a bit of time on it, so much so that Doug, to this day, teases me how long it took me to make the decision. Obviously, I'm really glad that I did. So just to make some observations, and I don't know that this is a surprise, but I think it's kind of at the core of what you're asking. You know, my role and our role at Goldman Sachs or the banks that I worked at in the public markets was really arranging to distribute leverage loans and high yield bonds to an investor base, CLOs, high yield mutual funds, and the like. And so ultimately, you're an intermediary. And so as an intermediary, you know, you're really making primarily a distribution judgment. Certainly, you do some due diligence. You want to make sure your documentation and risk factors are appropriate and have some understanding of the companies that you're underwriting. But the investment decision is being made by others. You know, in the private markets, you know, we're making a permanent investment decision on behalf of our clients. And so the level of rigor and work that we do in the private markets obviously is much deeper. And I'd say much deeper than really the public market participants are able to do. The public markets, your information and the time frame that you have to assess opportunities is quite limited. You've got a prospectus, you've got a bank book, you know, you've got a team that, you know, may have familiarity with the company. But you're making decisions sometimes measured in days or hours. In the private markets, you know, we do deep dive private equity style due diligence, often measured in months, where we get really, you know, direct access to the companies, to the private equity firms. It's just a lot more thorough, and, you know, which is commensurate with us owning illiquid assets for multiple years. So that's one, you know, major difference. The other, you know, sort of observation I would make looking back on it is, you know, we were making a bet that the private credit markets and direct lending would grow. You know, I obviously been surprised, you know, delightfully surprised at just how much growth there was. I thought there was an opportunity, don't get me wrong, but I didn't appreciate just how deep that opportunity was and the real thirst from the institutional market, the private wealth market, to really a willingness to sacrifice liquidity in exchange for return. And so the opportunity set has turned out to be just profoundly larger than we could have possibly hoped for. And obviously we'll get into that, you know, in the discussion, but that's been, you know, a delightful surprise.
Yeah, it clearly has become a real phenomena. So given, you know, how quickly this has shifted, I guess it all sort of started post the GFC with policymakers trying to de-risk the banks and pushing a lot of what was considered to be riskier lending out into the markets, both public and private. What do you say to those out there that believe that private credit is risky evolution in the capital markets, that the growth of private credit represents a systemic risk to the financial system? Do we know at this point of the cycle?
I think we do know. And I think that what I would say is, look, I understand, you know, I've been in the markets, you've been in the markets a long time. And anytime you have a market that's growing quickly, folks that aren't in the market are going to ask a question. What's driving this growth? Is there risk to it? I think the financial crisis in particular, I think, you know, was a real wake-up call to make sure that, you know, folks were examining the underpinnings of markets and where risk was. It doesn't concern me that someone will ask the question, because those are the kinds of questions that people will ask. What I'll tell you is, any reasonable, careful evaluation of the private credit markets, I think will be quite reassuring to those that worry about systemic risks to the financial system. As you kind of said, you know, what were the regulators trying to do after the financial crisis? They were trying to reduce the risk that banks were taking, because those risks were being borne ultimately by the taxpayer and ultimately by depositors who really didn't have a seat at the table in assessing that risk. And so a lot of the regulations were designed to have banks take on less risk. You know, our market, the private credit market, I think is pretty ideally suited to take that risk. And so as you study this, we are investing in illiquid assets, but we're doing it in a way that I think is pretty responsible. Our investors are investing in funds that don't offer daily liquidity. You know, we offer very limited liquidity, and some we have modest amounts of redemption. And so we're not allowing the investors to pull their money out at a time when they're investing in illiquid assets that aren't easily able to be monetized. We also have very modest leverage. Most of our funds are about one turn of leverage, and they're investment grade, including from KBRA, which we appreciate. And so they're modestly levered. They're properly capitalized with capital that is designed to be long-term in duration. And they are, you know, making term loans, and there's matched floating rate assets with floating rate liabilities. And so I would say, by and large, this is set up exactly how you would want it to be set up. So if you care to examine it, I think you come away saying, actually, this is a pretty reasonable outgrowth of what the regulators would have hoped for. And so I think that's what's going on here. I happen to also think that the assets themselves that we're investing in are actually of really good quality, and we can certainly talk about that. And, you know, again, and particularly at our firm at Blue Owl, where we're doing upper middle market private equity backed companies, I think that the assets are also of high quality, but the structures are set up in a way, I think, really, really designed to reduce risk. And the investors in our funds are willingly choosing to take that type of illiquid asset risk, understand it, understand what their liquidity profile is. And so I think it's a pretty sound system.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, our viewpoint on this, we've been big proponents, I think, of the, again, this what we consider to be positive evolution in capital markets for a lot of the reasons I think that you just talked about. One of the things that I think that longtime market participants in lending businesses, and I think you alluded to this a bit, when you do have something that is going to, whether it's a structural shift and you've got a reallocation of funds, at the end of the day, to some extent, some might say it's a commodity business, it's hard to differentiate yourself. How do you decommoditize the business from Blue Owl's perspective?
Look, we provide money. Money's green. Everybody's money's green. Sure, you know. But I think that, you know, the comparison to being a commodity kind of ends there. The reality is that our business is of very significant scale. You know, we have $85 billion of credit assets, which means that we can provide solutions to private equity firms, to borrowers, in a routine manner for hundreds of millions of dollars. And for any particular situation that we really like, as much as $1 billion, that we can do it in almost any industry group we choose, in multiple types of structures, customized, and hold it. And there are just very few firms that can do that. Our team has deep history in credit, and we have deep relationships with the private equity firms. Those relationships are differentiated. Private equity firms understand quite well who the borrowers are, and they value having long-term relationships with firms, with people they know and firms they've worked with, and they would prefer to have a very small group of lenders they go to on a regular basis. They're not simply just picking a random lender for each deal based on basis points. It's just not how they operate. And so we've been very fortunate. There's really just a handful of us in the private credit market that have all those tools under one roof. And that's, I think, one of the biggest factors of our success is very much that it is not a commodity. It's not something that anyone can do. And we bring a lot to bear.
Yeah. So, but talk a little bit about the competitive landscape, if you would, because the risk reward been so positive, so attractive. Naturally, you'd expect bigger and bigger players to sort of come in, commit more on both sides. Investors, whether it's institutional or high net worth, are going to find their way into the asset class. That's going to draw more capital to the space. Obviously, the banks have reawakened, or the public markets have reawakened here. Has that changed how you view the business as you think about the next, call it 12 to 24 months?
It really hasn't. It's so interesting that it really shows you how far the asset class has come, that it's now newsworthy that the banks are willing to do leverage finance deals. You know, it shows you just how far. The normal course of affairs is the banks are very active participants in the market. They do that by distributing the risk, as we talked about earlier. And certainly in our history, almost the entire history, the banks have been wide open to underwrite and distribute leverage finance deals. But early last year, they weren't. And so that happened to be an exceptionally good moment for direct lending, where we were the only game in town. But if you look at 2021, which was a record year for direct lending, the banks were wide open as well. You know, we will exist right alongside the banks. There's more capital that's come in the space. There's new entrants. The returns have attracted capital. I think it will continue to do so. We're a big beneficiary of that. But the other side of the equation has grown as well, which is the addressable market. As more capital has formed in the space, bigger and bigger deals, more and more deals are getting done with direct lenders. And so I call this the secular shift. The secular shift is to direct lenders, and the private equity firms like it, and they're using the solution for bigger and bigger deals. And so as more capital is in the space, it's allowing that to happen. You know, the simple example, you know, the $1 billion unitranche. When we started our business in 2016, it had been a $1 billion unitranche. A couple of years later was the first one. It was this big moment. Now it's common. In fact, now it's common. We're doing deals 2, 3, 4, 5 billion at a clip. Why is that? Well, because now there's enough capital where you can actually do a $3 billion direct deal. The sponsors are preferring it. But that is opening up just a much deeper part of the market for us. And so that's growing the opportunity set. So that secular shift is going to continue, but there are going to be the cyclical ups and downs. There are going to be moments in time, and we're in one now. You know, just let's be, you know, candid. We're in one now, which is there's not a lot of deal flow. Both markets are open. There's a lot of private capital formation. And so at this particular moment in time, on March 7th, you know, it's a good time to be a borrower because there's a lot of capital out there and you're seeing some spread compression. This too will change. They'll, you know, for better or for worse, you know, markets get volatile. For the course of any year, you'll still see the cycle will come up, the cycle will go down. So I don't get too focused on quarter to quarter. Over the next few years, I think the more and more opportunities will come to private credit. We're seeing a lot of interest, certainly from investors in the asset class, and a lot of interest from borrowers. And I think that'll generally result in more and more deals coming our way.
Yeah. So reflect back, if you would, a little bit. You were there, obviously, in the public market side. You watched sort of the cov-lite regime sort of take root. We're seeing a bit of that now in private credit. How does that all move as we think about the business going forward? Are we going to go down that same sort of path where you're going to have to give something just to sort of continue to win your share of deals?
The short answer is, and I think this should be intuitive, it makes sense to offer a company. Just think about it. I'm talking about a $3 billion private credit deal. We lend out at about 40% loan to value. Let's just call it 50% loan to value. You're talking about a $6 billion company. I would think it's intuitive to any investor that a $6 billion company that has $3 billion of equity in it probably deserves a higher level of flexibility than what used to be done in the direct lending market, which was a $30 million EBITDA company that, you know, was worth, you know, maybe it was worth a few $100 million. So the covenants are different, you know, given the quality of the companies. And covenant light is definitely more prevalent today in direct lending than it was 6 or 7 years ago. However, I think that that headline really, again, is misleading, because the issue in the public markets is not whether it's covenant light or not. You know, that's just a soundbite. The issue is that the documentation in the public markets is being provided by the banks who work for the borrowers to try to get the borrowers the weakest set of covenants they possibly can and the most flexibility. And, you know, if your job is in the leveraged finance business at a bank, you're being pushed and you want to push the market to accept the weakest terms possible. And when the markets get frothy, the markets will accept that weakness, in part because the buyers of those loans are buying tiny little pieces. And so while they would prefer better protections, they don't have any leverage because they're just buying little pieces. It's very different in the private markets. We are negotiating our credit agreements directly with the borrower without an intermediary. We care deeply about those protections, and we have to, because we're going to hold 50, 70, 100% of the loan. We're the bank in this example. We're providing ongoing liquidity to the company in the form of a revolving credit facility. We're facing the CFO and getting updates quarterly, monthly. We simply have to have those protections. So I will acknowledge that we, as the companies get bigger, we are often not having a true maintenance covenant, although we typically will have one in a revolver if it's drawn above a certain amount. But what we won't live with is the rest of the documentation being weak that will allow asset stripping or dividends to come out or capital flow into some subsidiary that we no longer control. We just simply can't allow that to happen. The other aspect is we generally have one group of creditors. There's not these multiple layer capital structures. And so it's one group of like-minded lenders in a concentrated manner. And the documentation continues to be, I think, very protective of us. And we simply have to have it that way. And certainly at Blue Owl, we're only willing to live, with those types of protections. So I think it's fair to say that it allows greater flexibility, but I don't think that flexibility has any meaningful impact on the creditworthiness of the loans that we're making.
Yeah, I got it. So let's shift gears a little bit and kind of put you in sort of a macro seat. You know, it's hard to imagine that anybody's going to have a better view of sort of hard landing versus soft landing than a lender of your size and scale. With all those touch points out there across the U.S., what do you see from a macro standpoint in terms of the economy? And, you know, how are you positioning yourself into this environment? First, let's define what you think it looks like over the next, you know, call it year to 18 months. And how are you positioning as a result?
I'll answer your question, but before I do, I want to set the stage for it. We are decidedly not trying to be a leading indicator of the U.S. economy. Quite the opposite. And I think it's very important to understand. One of the great attributes, I think, of direct lending is we're cherry-picking the sectors. And in our case specifically, we're deliberately trying to lend to recession-resistant businesses that won't cycle. So our biggest sectors, software, healthcare, food and beverage, insurance brokerage, distribution businesses, you'll find very little companies in our portfolio that are like really heavy cyclicals. We just really try to avoid them. So you won't see almost any chemicals, metals, home building, retail, restaurants. And so I think that's one of the great positive attributes of direct lending. I think many public market funds tend to want to match an index, high yield or leveraged loans. And so they play all these cyclical sectors. And so we're not going to be an early warning sign because we're not in those sectors. So to answer your question, our companies are doing just fine. We're continuing to see pretty broad-based growth, modest growth, low single-digit growth, revenues and cash flow in really, really in all our sectors. And I expect that to continue. Last year, I do these calls and the audience was quite skeptical, right? Because everyone thought the economy is going to roll or rates were going to go up. And this is really, you know, this was going to be the moment. There was almost glee in the eyes of some asking us these questions. And obviously quite the opposite. You know, direct lending did extremely well last year. If you weren't in direct lending funds, you underperformed. And so why is that? Well, these are good companies and that was underappreciated. And the U.S. economy held up quite well. The other thing we really benefited from was some untangling of some of the supply chain issues that cropped up during COVID. Commodity prices had spiked. So we've seen a lot of margin improvement over the last 12 months. Look, we're a lender. I'm not an equity holder. We're conservative. We don't bet on robust economic conditions. We just worry about how bad it can get. I think our base case operating assumption is going to continue to be a modestly slow growing U.S. economy that certainly in the near term, rates continue to be high. You know, short-term rates have not come down. And so our borrowers, they're paying, their interest rate is pegged off short-term rates. So their debt service is high. You know, I think that will start to alleviate, in the back half of the year. But, I'm expecting we'll still have some companies, some of our weaker performers will get caught up in this. It's been 18 months or so of higher rates. Maybe they're not the slow grower. They're shrinking a bit. They've got some issues. And so we may have some credit issues that crop up as a result, but it'll be very manageable in the context of a broad portfolio that's doing well. If rates probably stay a little higher for longer than maybe what people think, but over the next 12, 24 months, I think generally rates will come down. It's going to start to alleviate some of the debt service pressures that some of the borrowers feel. And, I'd like to think that will result in continued positive developments in the economy. Seems like it's going to continue to be reasonable. I'm not going to call for robust economic conditions. I don't see a meaningful recession either, but let's see what the next 3 or 6 months bring.
Yeah. So talk to a little bit about sort of the workout function as we start to think about how you sort of get through, whether it's a higher for longer environment or whether it is a slowing growth or probably some combination of the two. Walk us through the resource allocation you have to make, right, in terms of being able to, work out problem credits most efficiently. Is that a daunting task from your perspective, or is that something that you're geared up to do at this stage of the cycle?
It's just part of business for us. I mean, I think that's one of the sort of necessary requirements. We talked about, commodity or not, like this is one of the things you just have to do. If you're going to be a direct lender of scale like we are, you have to have workout expertise. We have a workout team. We have our workout team set up in a way that works very closely with our existing underwriting team. We don't have a handed off type of structure. Some firms do. We keep our existing teams involved and have all the resident knowledge, but we have a number of professionals who are career workout folks and really understand that process. So we have to have that. It's part of what we do. And I think it's a very valuable aspect of direct lending. We talk about recovery rates. One of the reasons why I think direct lending recovery rates will be good is this ability to take a long-term time horizon, work out your problems and address them. And we have that. And I certainly don't want to say that we're happy if we have a company that goes in a workout. Of course, that's something you're trying to avoid if at all possible, but it's not a daunting proposition. There are times that we bend over backwards to allow the private equity firm to support their businesses and keep their businesses. That'd be our preference. But if they can't, sometimes they just can't. They don't have the capital to do it, or they won't because they feel that there's not a value in it for them. In those rare circumstances, we will step in. And to a greater extent than you might think, it tends to be a fairly professional and cordial situation. The private equity firms, they don't want to have to do it. They don't want to have their management teams have to go through it. So they kind of do it. They want to do it in a professional way, in a smooth way to preserve value for the business. And we work through these problems. And over time, we haven't had a lot. Our loss ratio at our firm is 6 basis points. We've had, less than a handful of workouts, but we've had some terrific outcomes and gotten par recoveries. But, believe it or not, even we've had a loan that we've had to take over. So part of what we do, part of what any large scale direct lender does, and it's really a way for us to provide a lot of value to our clients by getting high recoveries with our problem credits.
Yeah, sort of makes sense. If I think through the equation, it's just part and parcel to the business. And it seems like you're clearly advantageously scaled where you need to be with regard to whatever the economy is going to throw at us here. Talk to me a little bit about going after the wealth channel. Are there different considerations than the world that you've played in historically? I mean, what are some of the considerations that you have to think about in tapping into that that pool of funds?
From the beginning of starting, the predecessor Owl Rock, part of our strategy was to enter the wealth channel. And this was 2016, which at that time, it wasn't on many firms' radar screens. We were early. My partner, Doug and Mark, I think rightly foresaw that there'd be growing appetite for alternatives in the wealth channel. Their previous firms, Blackstone, KKR, you know, I think had some perspective on that. And so we position ourselves, you know, squarely to be able to attack that. And we're quite proud of what we've built there. We're really one of the leaders in raising capital in the private wealth channel. We have terrific partnerships with some of the wirehouses and RIAs. We had worked side by side with them for years to develop partnerships to allow their advisors to raise capital from their clients with our products. It's a really exciting area. It's got fantastic potential. Really, honestly, we're just scratching the surface. Part of that strategy, when we conceived of it, was we went to the partners. Again, we sell these through an intermediary, or products through an intermediary, and said, we're going to design structures that fit your client base. For example, in the institutional channel, the institutions are used to dealing with drawdown capital. Make a commitment, it gets drawn over 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Wealthy individuals don't want that hassle. They want to be able to commit and write a check. So we had to design funds that had the structures that were suitable for the client base. But we said, we're going to give you the same exact investment experience as the biggest institutions. And we did some things in the way we design our business to allow that to happen. One investment funnel, deals get allocated across funds, but it's the same deals that are showing up in the funds for the wealth channel as in the institutional channel. And so that combination, customization of structure, but common investment opportunities, I think was really powerful. And it's one of the reasons that we've had success. So to answer your question, do we need to do something different? We have to invest a lot of resources and time building those relationships, servicing those networks, being able to deliver a great experience. You know, we work with firms like Merrill Lynch. They have thousands of advisors with hundreds of thousands of customers. I mean, we have to invest a lot in being able to have those relationships, make sure the information is accurate, answer questions, support them. It's just a big resource and a big lift. And those partnerships have been one of the reasons for our success. I just want to make a point, which might be obvious to you, but I'll also make it anyway. We have folks who are expert at doing that. I didn't have that background when I was at Goldman. You know, but we have folks, not only my partners, but our leaders in our private wealth business, Sean Connor and others that have been doing this their whole careers and are expert in it. And so while we have grown, we haven't had to invent this. We've hired folks that have spent their careers doing it and do a wonderful job.
Okay. Maybe before we wrap things up, one last question on sort of regulation. It pops up in news flow from time to time. I think I'm still waiting to trip across the first executive who is in favor of regulation, but is there positive regulation that you think would serve the asset class well over time, or is this better left to be disciplined by markets? But where do you come down on sort of the regulatory issue?
Well, I don't want to break your track record of running into executives that are looking for more regulation. You know, look, we're going to live with whatever regulatory environment exists. I guess what I would say is similar to my comment earlier, I can understand why any regulator would see, oh, there's a part of the market that's grown a lot. You know, let's take a look. And that's okay. But I actually think when they take a look, they're going to see a lot of aspects that they should like. I think these private credit is really a pro-regulator approach to the capital markets. We're matching up investors, institutions, or wealthy individuals who are consciously deciding to lock up their capital and invest in illiquid assets knowingly, allowing themselves to be in funds that don't allow for redemptions in any great scale with moderate leverage. And so I think that, my opinion, that's a positive structure. And you know, if regulators have suggestions of things to improve, of course, we'll all respond to that. But I don't think that there's inherently something that regulators would find objectionable about it. Last point I would make is for our firm in particular, the vast majority of our capital is in the form of BDCs, business development companies. Business development companies are quite transparent. You know, whether our funds are public or private, they are public filers. These are 40 Act companies. We file 10Ks and 10Qs every quarter. Every single investment that we have is in those 10Qs with a mark every quarter, reviewed by an accounting firm. And we have independent board members, you know, that work for the shareholders, that are the shareholders' representatives. So you know, we'll hear, sometimes I hear this like shadow banking. There's nothing shadow about it. Like, go on Edgar, call it the 10K or 10Q, and you can see what we do. So I don't want to make light of, you know, regulation. You know, I've been in financial markets or regulated markets. Regulators are there to prevent excessive risk. And so if there are developments, you know, we will be the first in line to want to respond to them in a thoughtful way. But I think there's nothing I can see that's of particular concern.
I got it. Well, let's leave it there. Greg, you've been very generous with your time today. Thank you for really terrific insights into a market that everybody is looking for insight into. You know, we thank you for your time again. Thanks for joining us.
Great, Dan. Thank you. Thanks for having me. We appreciate our relationship with KBRA and look forward to many years to come.
Terrific. Thanks for listening to our latest Leading Voices in Credit podcast. Make sure you tune in every month for a new episode, and don't forget to tune in weekly for our Three Things in Credit podcast. Happy listening. Hello, listeners. Join me, Van Hessert, KBRA's chief strategist, and thousands of listeners each Friday for the latest episode of my Three Things in Credit podcast, where I reveal three things in credit markets that you should know about. That's Van Hessert's Three Things in Credit. Subscribe now.